university's investment policy. So what's your response to them on that?
It's slightly unclear as to whether or not it's entirely the university's investment policy or actually our broader activities in supporting research and education in defence technologies. My response to that is that we're not a university that holds very large scale investments. The investments we do have, we make responsibly and with an eye to our collective fiduciary duties. That's a matter for the council of the university. I should say, I am wholly unembarrassed by the fact that we are closely engaged with defence and defence industries. I believe these industries are vital in defence of democracy. For the UK's
Well, prospect. You're my big brother, and I shouldn't interrupt you, but the programme's going to finish in a second, so I have to. Anthony Finkelstein, President of City St George's, thank you very much for you. Thank you for your company this afternoon, all you listeners. Next on Times Radio, very excited today, it's Dom Jolly.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you, Danny. Enjoyed that think tank, as we call it, I think. Good afternoon. It's 2 o'clock. You're listening to Dom Jolly in for Jane and Fee on Times Radio. Coming up on the show today, Keir Starmer's defending the inquiry into grooming gangs amid accusations of a cover-up from the Conservatives. The Times reports that Rachel Reeves has lawyers and accountants in her sights for a tax rise. We'll hear what that would mean. My big interview after 3:30 is with the Emmy-winning star of Veep. I'm very excited. Tony Hale on his new film. And I'm asking a very important question. What is wrong with people who run marathons? And why do they like them? But first, the news with James Kitchen.
Thank you, Dom. Good afternoon. The Conservative leader has accused the government of launching a briefing war against grooming gang survivors after four resigned from a panel establishing a national inquiry. One alleged a toxic environment, while another feared perpetrators' racial and religious motivations would be downplayed. Speaking at Prime Minister's Questions, the Keir Starmer repeated that the investigation won't be watered down, but Kemi Badenoch says Labour's trying to cover up failings.
Labour never wanted this inquiry. We demanded it. It has been Labour-run councils, Trafford, Bradford, Blackpool, that try to suppress the truth. It is Labour ministers attacking the victims. We're standing up for them.
A judge in Sheffield has allowed the identification of the killer of the teenager Harvey Wilgoose. The 15-year-old was stabbed in the heart by Muhammad Umar Khan at school in front of other students in February. Khan was found guilty of murder in August and will be sentenced this afternoon. Reporter Katerina Vitozzi, who's outside Sheffield Crown Court, says the attack was chilling.
We know that Umar Khan, as he was referred to during the trial here, brought a 13-centimetre hunting knife into school with him that day. And in an attack which happened just outside the school canteen, in just two blows, he fatally stabbed Harvey Wilgoose.
Inflation was unchanged in September for a third month running. CPI came in at 3.8%, lower than some analysts predicted, but well above the Bank of England's 2% target. James Murray is Chief Secretary to the Treasury.
Well, look, we're not satisfied with these numbers about inflation, and we know that too many people across the country feel like they're putting more in and getting less out. And it's the responsibility of all of us in government to support the Bank of England in getting inflation down. And that's why we're absolutely determined to do more to help people who are struggling with the cost of living and to build an economy that works for working people.
September's numbers are used to calculate by how much benefits and pensions go by up in April for the next financial year. The US Vice President J.D. Vance has expressed optimism about Gaza's fragile ceasefire as he held talks with Israel's Prime Minister. The peace plan had appeared in doubt over the weekend after a burst of violence, but is holding up for now. Mr. Vance, who's been welcomed to Jerusalem by Benjamin Netanyahu, says it's actually going better than expected.
Nothing existed, even a week and a day ago. That's going to require a lot of work. It requires a lot of ingenuity. But again, having seen what's already been built in just the past 7 days, I think that we're on an incredible pathway here to do something that has never been done.
And Storm Benjamin is expected to hit the UK with heavy downpours and winds of up to 70 miles per hour. The Met Office has issued yellow weather warnings covering most of southern England, the East Midlands, parts of Wales and Yorkshire tomorrow. It says flooding, power cuts and damage to buildings are all possible. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on the Times radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. Weekday afternoons on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms.
Good afternoon, everybody. This is me, Dom Jolly. I'm sitting in again for Jane and Fee. I had the pleasure of bumping into them both, actually, last week in my hometown of Cheltenham at the Lit Fest, and they were very nice, so I think everything's okay. I'm actually personally coming down from one of the best weeks of my life. The TV show I used to make, Trigger Happy TV, is 25 years old, and to celebrate, I did four live shows, ending up with just an incredible night at the Adelphi on the Strand. So just thank you to anybody who came to that show. They were, honestly, it felt like the end of Spinal Tap when they go to Japan and walk out on stage and everyone's there. It was absolutely amazing. I'm also, I hope it won't sort of sound in my voice, but I'm injured today, sports injury. My Achilles has completely gone. It's a marathon injury. I don't want to go on about it. It's no big deal. I was in Amsterdam, not actually doing the marathon. I went there to watch my son run it, and I got injured just walking around Amsterdam trying to see him. He was raising money for Friedrich's ataxia, which is a very little-known disease that needs way more awareness. And Jane and Fee are actually kind enough to cover an interview with a mother and a son who suffers from Friedrich's a week or so ago. So thank you for that. And he ran a very impressive 3 hours 31 and raised a lot of money. So bravo to him. I am a proud dad today. But anyway, let's move on. The most read stories on the Times website this afternoon. Number three is double-decker Eurostar trains to roll into London. High-speed double-decker trains with a capacity of up to 1,000 passengers could be rolling into St Pancras as early as 2031. The second most read story, never mind tax rises, runaway inflation is already squeezing us dry. And that's by the Times' money editor, Joanna Noble. And the most read piece on the Times website is tax raid on solicitors and GPs as Rachel Reeves targets the wealthy. We'll talk all about what that will mean shortly. And you can read all those articles on thetimes.com. You'll need your digital subscription. And if you don't have one, well, get one. Go to thetimes.com/subscribe. Keir Starmer is insisting that the inquiry into the grooming gangs will not be watered down amid fierce criticism at Prime Minister's questions.
The inquiry is not and will never be watered down. Its scope will not change. It will examine the ethnicity and religion of the offenders, and we will find the right person to chair the inquiry. I can tell the House today, Mr Speaker, that Dame Louise Casey will now support the work of the inquiry, and it will get to the truth. Injustice will have no place to hide.
Keir Starmer there. Four survivors of the scandal have quit the inquiry amid anger at delays and fears that the scope could be widened to other forms of abuse. The safeguarding minister, Jess Phillips, denies claims that the scope could be changed. That's disputed by Fiona Goddard, one of the survivors, who spoke to Times Radio Breakfast.
I do not think a woman that can call a survivor of the grooming gangs a liar publicly to save her own skin should be in a position of protecting and safeguarding women and children. I am deeply concerned over the lack of acknowledgement over what has happened today. I think it is disrespectful. Although I am happy to now have it confirmed that the concerns raised over the attempts to expand the scope will now stop. It will have a specific focus. That is reassuring.
Danny Shaw is a policing crime and justice commentator. Danny, there are reports just as we're coming on air that Jim Gamble, a former police chief in the frame to lead the inquiry, has pulled out. What would that mean?
Well, I think that would be a huge blow for the government that's trying to set up this inquiry and get it off the ground. And also, personally, I think it's a real shame because I think Jim Gamble would have been an excellent chair. He led the Child Exploitation and Online Protection Centre, known as CEOP, before it was sort of subsumed into the National Crime Agency, and he led it impressively, and it really punched above his weight. He's carried out a number of independent reviews and inquiries into safeguarding concerns and child protection issues. And if anyone thinks that he would be sort of, a patsy for the government or for the police service, they're very much mistaken. Jim Gamble's hugely independent, fiercely sort of guards his independence, and he will speak truth to power. So personally, I think it's a real shame that he's pulled out.
So with that in mind, I mean, what is the grievance, the central grievance of those who've left the inquiry?
I think their central grievance is, firstly, that there was a sense that the inquiry might be widened to cover non-grooming gang child abuse issues, which it seems some members of the survivors panel didn't want to happen. And I should say, I don't think that's a unanimous view of all of them, because we've certainly heard comments from one of them who agrees that it should take into account other forms of sexual abuse. And I think the other issue is about choosing the chair, because, again, some members of the survivors group saying we don't want someone from an institution that is basically, partly responsible for the mess that we're in, either a social worker who pulled out, Annie Hudson, or Jim Gamble, who's an ex-police officer. These are really, really delicate and difficult issues to get right. We've seen it before when the ICSA, the National Inquiry into Child Sexual Abuse, was set up by Theresa May when she was Home Secretary. They went through, I think, three chairs before they actually got one who had the confidence of victims, survivors and others. It was a terribly messy process. Also, I think I seem to remember some real concerns around the selection of the chair of the Grenfell Tower inquiry, although, later turned out that I think he was widely respected for what he'd done. So these things are really, really difficult to get right. I mean, I would say this, Dom, I think perhaps it was a mistake after Baroness Louise Casey had done her sort of interim report, her report about the need for a national inquiry, to sort of let her go. I think perhaps she should have been kept on through this sort of process and ensuring that the right chair was appointed with the right terms of reference. And then perhaps she could have stepped back, because she does have the confidence, I think, of everyone. And it's very significant now that Keir Starmer said that she will be supporting the inquiry. Perhaps that, they should have done that from the outset, because it was June that her report was published. We're now 4 months down the line, still no chair, still no terms of reference. It's going to be well into next year before this thing gets going.
So Kemi Badenoch was gunning for the resignation of the safeguarding minister, Jess Phillips, at Prime Minister's Questions earlier.
The victims have said that she should be sacked. We on this side of the House believe that she should be sacked, because this is about Labour failure. Labour never wanted this inquiry. We demanded it. It has been Labour-run councils, Trafford, Bradford, Blackpool, that try to suppress the truth. It is Labour ministers attacking the victims. We're standing up for them. And how is it, Mr. Speaker, how is it that whether it is rape or Chinese espionage, when he's in a position to do something about it, it's always someone else's fault?
So Jess Phillips a little bit in the firing line there. How likely is Kemi Badenoch to get what she wants?
No, I don't think Jess Phillips is going to resign. I don't think Keir Starmer is going to sack her, and I don't think he should. Jess Phillips has done more work in this field in terms of domestic abuse and violence against women than Kemi Badenoch has ever done. She's done more work in this field than, almost every other politician that sits in the House of Commons. This is being politicised by the Conservatives that hardly mention the issue of grooming gangs when they were in office. Kemi Badenoch, I don't think, when she was Equalities Minister, never raised the subject at all. This has become a political football. I understand why that's the case. But what I think the government must do and should do is get this right, stick with Jess Phillips in the post and leading this inquiry with the support of Louise Casey. And I think they can. I think those two people can get this right and can appoint the right person to lead this. I understand why some of the survivors were crossed, because they had heard Jess Phillips say, no, this is going to concentrate on grooming gangs. And then there was some sort of consultation process where a question was asked, do you want it to be widened? That doesn't mean it will be widened. But I think that there are some survivors who feel that you can't understand the issue around grooming gangs unless you also look at wider issues of sexual abuse. And that's a completely legitimate point of view to take into account when you're setting the parameters of the inquiry.
Keir Starmer's also been defending his decision not to appoint a judge to oversee the inquiry, and he said there were two reasons for this.
The first was the speed with which we could do this. The second is really important, and that is that at the same time as the inquiry, I was absolutely determined that criminal investigations would go on at the same time. One of the problems that judge-led inquiries run into is that they're often held back until the end of the criminal investigations. And I was determined that we'd be able to run the two together. And it's because of that, Mr. Speaker, that we've been able to reopen 1,200 historic cases at the same time.
Do you think that could backfire?
No, I think I think the point is that I think Louise Casey's recommendation was not that there should be some very formal judge-led public inquiry. I don't think she suggested that. It should be an inquiry that has the power to compel witnesses to give evidence and for documents to be produced. And so it will need those statutory powers, and it will need, obviously, legal input at a high level, people who understand the law, who are very close to the chair. But I think, you know, the main reason was, I think, to try and avoid that formality. I'm not sure that Keir Starmer's quite right about criminal investigations, you know, having to take priority. I mean, whether it's a judge leading it or someone else doing it, I think the two can run in parallel. But ultimately, even if you appoint a judge, they come from the judiciary, from institutions that have also let down the survivors and victims of child sexual abuse. There is no institution that isn't really touched in some way or affected or involved in, you know, wider issues around grooming gangs and the failure to investigate, prosecute and convict the perpetrators. So very difficult to find someone probably that's going to satisfy everyone. What you've got to do, I think, is look beyond the label of the person and look at the character of the individual concerned who's being put forward to lead this inquiry.
Ellie Reynolds, another of the survivors who quit the panel, said she thought the government was scared of being seen as racist. I mean, this perceptions of racism go right back to the beginning of this scandal, doesn't it? How big a concern is it?
Well, I mean, that's what the Conservatives are really getting at here. What they're really getting at and driving at by making this political football is Labour doesn't really want this inquiry. They never wanted this inquiry. And now they're trying to water it down because they don't want their own Labour-led councils to be exposed as having sort of brushed this problem under the carpet for the sake of political correctness, because it was in the too difficult box, because it would mean that some of the perpetrators would be identified as from ethnic minorities. That's kind of what the Conservatives are getting at. We know from what Louise Casey said in her report, that a disproportionate numbers of men were from Asian ethnic backgrounds among some of the groups that perpetrated grooming gangs. Although the evidence, the data is really, really poor around that, and that needs to be rectified. I think this inquiry will get to the bottom of that. I really do. But it's overcoming some of these political hurdles and some of the political footballs that are being knocked about that the government is really battling with at the moment.
Just stepping away from this row for a minute, there's a faintly unbelievable story that's just broken. A man who was sent to France under Keir Starmer's new one-in, one-out deal has told The Guardian he came back on a small boat. How embarrassing is that for the government?
This is definitely an embarrassment, but it is probably something that was predictable. If you're sending lots of people back to France, and I think 20 or 30 have gone back already, who don't want to go back, and who clearly had the means to get to the UK in the first place, it's not surprising that one or two won't attempt to make the journey and may be successful in doing so. I think the question now is for the government to make it absolutely clear that anyone who does that will be on the first flight back to Paris straight away. And I think Martin Hewitt, who's the Director General or the Border Security Commander, the new unit that was set up to sort of tackle illegal immigration and the small boats, was rather hazy about this point last week when he appeared before MPs. And I think he should have been absolutely clear that that will happen. If you've been removed once, you'll be removed again. And it'll be easy for the authorities to identify you because they'll already have your fingerprints, probably your DNA, and so on. So as soon as you sort of step off that small boat for a second time, you'll be identified as someone that was removed to France, and you should be on a flight immediately. There should be no questions asked. And the government really needs to come out and make it absolutely clear that that's the case.
That was Danny Shaw, policing, crime and justice commentator, and also a former advisor to Labour's Yvette Cooper. Don't forget, you can get in touch with the show. WhatsApp 0333 003 2353. Use hashtag Times Radio and get in touch. Tell us what you think. Coming up, the big question: can you be addicted to running marathons? It's 2:19. This is Dom Jolly on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
John Pienaar on Times Radio. Trusted journalism.
Well, today we are watching the world order being demolished and rebuilt pretty much at the whim of two strongman leaders.
Intelligent analysis.
But it adds to the impression that life is hard and maybe too hard under the new government.
And diverse opinion.
We'll be hearing the thoughts and the arguments on either sides and in between and some of the complex issues. How can this end well?
John Pienaar, A Drive. This afternoon from 4 on Times Radio.
DJ! At PlusNet, we think switching broadband should be as easy as flicking a switch.
Switch!
With one touch switch, our team will handle all the admin, helping you wave goodbye to your old broadband provider and get set up with us instead. Switch to PlusNet today and get fast and reliable full fibre. That's A++.
DJ!
Plus. New customers only, 24-month contract, limited availability, terms apply.
When you're growing a small business, you need someone who understands the ins and outs. And whether you're a tailor or an accountant, you need the tools to succeed. With an HSBC Small Business Banking account, you'll have free accounting tools and access to our business specialists, virtually or in person. Because whatever your small business looks like, we're with you all the way. Search HSBC Small Business Banking account to get started. Subject to application, eligibility, credit check and T's and C's. Visit hsbc.co.uk for details.
Here's the truth about AI. AI is only as powerful as the platform it's built into. ServiceNow puts AI to work for people across your business, removing friction and frustration for your employees, supercharging productivity for your developers, providing intelligent tools for your service agents to make customers happier. All built into a single platform you can use right now. That's why the world works with ServiceNow. Visit servicenow.com/UK/AI for people.
Amazon offers term time working to their employees, like Anton, who's home to look after his daughters during their holidays.
Hello!
To him, this is the best sound in the world. Actually, maybe that's the best sound of all. Now that's term time working. Offered at Amazon. 10 weeks off guaranteed per year. Mix of paid holiday and unpaid time off. Conditions apply.
Listen at 6:30 every weekday morning for your indispensable briefing on the latest politics, business and sports news of the day.
Weekday afternoons on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms. Helping create rooms to feel proud of. From design consultants who'll measure your space and bring your vision to life on a 3D plan, through to a professional installation service. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Welcome back. I'm Dom Jolly here on Times Radio. The Times and Sunday Times have just launched a fantastic new podcast, The Poppy Day Bomb, which investigates what happened in November 1987 when an IRA bomb exploded in the Northern Irish town of Enniskillen. It killed 11 people, but no one has ever been charged. The series is presented by The Times' Mario Ledwith, who was born in the town 2 days after the explosion. Mario returns to his hometown to ask who carried out these bloody murders, how the authorities failed to properly investigate, and why a silence continues to surround what happened. You can listen to The Poppy Day Bomb now on your favourite podcast platform. And Times subscribers can access the first four episodes now by connecting their subscription through Apple Podcasts. Ready, set, go. And run 200 marathons in 200 days. That's the challenge a 33-year-old woman in Suffolk has embarked on this week. And more than 1.1 million people have entered the ballot for the 2026 London Marathon, which isn't only a world record, but nearly double the figure from 2 years ago. I'm just back from my own marathon, watching my son take part in the Amsterdam one, and I wanted to find out what's behind this marathon fever. So I've been speaking to Hannah Evans, the Times deputy food editor, and she began by telling me how many marathons she's run.
I am, I guess, a marathon addict is what you might describe me as. I've now run five.
And five?
Five, I know.
And why?
Well, I think if you had asked me 10 years ago, I'm 31 now, you know, if I'd ever run a marathon, I would laugh at you because I was not a runner at school. I wasn't athletic. I was very much the last person to be picked for all teams when it came to sport. But like lots and lots of people, I really got into exercise and running in lockdown.
I did that.
Yeah.
I did couch potato to 5K. I made it to 1K and then stopped. That doesn't mean you do five marathons.
I think that a lot of people find they find the adrenaline and the endorphins quite addictive.
So there is an addiction to it,
yes.
Right? You get a running high.
You do. And I think it's a feeling that's really difficult to describe until you've experienced it.
But I'm interested in that running high because do you have to do a... Because it seems to me that... You're taking that high. It feels like you're overdosing in a sense because there must be negative effects when you've done a marathon. Can you not get that high from a 5K?
Well, that's a very sensible way of looking at it. And it's what lots of people from my family to my boyfriend ask me when I say I'm going out on another long run. And the truth is, I mean, of course you can. You can get the high after doing a park run. But there's something that also comes when you do a marathon with the sense of satisfaction and achievement that comes once you've crossed the line. Marathons aren't easy to train for. And I know the lady that you mentioned is trying to do 200 in 200 days.
That's just showing off.
Which seems mad.
Yeah.
But it takes so much hard work, you know. And if you want to go faster, you have to run even more. And it takes months of dedication. You know, you're training through really trying periods of weather as well. You've got to make so many sacrifices from evening and weekend plans to losing toenails.
I want to talk about the chafing elements.
That's all part of it. And I think that there is something really unique about the feeling that comes when you cross the line after all of that work. That is something that if I could really bottle up and experience, you know, anytime I would, but the fact that you can't get it until you've crossed a line after that much hard work is, I think, what makes, you know, it so addictive.
I mean, my son just did it. He's not, frankly, a natural runner, I don't think, but suddenly he was on Strava, he had Strava mates, he was doing what seemed like really fast times, but till he did the marathon, he'd never actually run that distance. So there was part of me thinking, oh, he's not going to do it.
Yeah.
But he nailed it. 3:31. That was really, it's amazing.
That's fantastic.
And I thought, that's it. You can stop now.
Yeah.
And he literally came off and said, I'm doing another one.
Yeah, I know. I've been there.
Stop? I mean, surely in a bit, marathons aren't going to be enough. You'll start doing ultra marathons or Marathon des Sables.
Well, I have also done two of those as well.
You haven't.
I have, yeah. And
is
I
this
mean,
because you're the food editor? Is this?
I think part of it came from that. I mean, there is, you know, and my job is a very calorific one.
Yeah.
And I'm not somebody who kind of wants to sit still or let myself just sort of bloat in size. I definitely kind of came from wanting to balance out the quantity that I have to eat and drink with my job. But I think what we've seen over the last year is how much running and exercise has become a social thing as well, particularly for people who are in their 20s and early 30s.
So I've met running clubs and stuff. And,
yeah.
And that's a good way. And also Strava is kind of like social media for
exactly,
joggers, right?
Exactly.
Jake Jackson, my son, was just thinking about his Strava cred.
And
it was amazing.
I've been there. I still am there. I go to three running clubs a week. I spend I spend an embarrassing amount of time running.
But is it good for you? I know this is probably an urban myth, but I seem to remember the guy who invented jogging died of a heart attack while jogging. Is that true or is that just an urban myth?
I haven't heard that, but I think that you definitely need to be quite sensible with your approach. Often you hear about people getting into running and then getting injured, and that tends to be doing it too much too quickly.
Yeah.
I have a kind of foundation in gym going and exercising way before I started running. And I think that people often negate strength training when they get into running. And actually the best way to prevent yourself from injury is to lift weights and make sure your muscles are really strong to support you.
Rather than they get totally shocked.
Exactly. And I think also fueling yourself adequately stops you from...
Pre-fueling you.
Yeah. And also afterwards as well. I think that for a very long time, particularly if you're a woman who is in their 30s or 40s, like running, it was something to burn calories. It was like a... It was sort of going for a job to kind of...
A punishment. Almost.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's what's been so great about this massive shift towards running becoming a sociable thing, is that people are doing it for the enjoyment and doing it because it's a great way to see places. It's a great way to socialize.
Isn't it a good trip ruined? I mean, you're going off to these great cities,
yeah,
and then torturing yourself.
Well,
but after the marathon, I stayed in Amsterdam. Oh my God, the amount of people hobbling into restaurants and then getting absolutely hammered.
Well, there was actually a very interesting statistic from Strava and Airbnb, who have said among Gen Z, who are that kind of age group under 28, the idea of a runcation has now replaced city breaks.
I totally get that.
And I get it as well. It's such a great way to kind of feel and see a city.
Just watching you kind of, you're like excited about thinking about. Can I ask you two questions?
Yeah.
What's the dream marathon that you haven't done?
Mm.
And what's considered to be the hardest? Is there a Nepalese marathon where you're running uphill? Or,
well, Boston is traditionally known as a very, very hard one because it's hilly. That I think it's called Heartbreak Mile, Hill.
My nephew's been trying to get in for ages.
Yeah.
You have to break a certain time, and he's finally got in.
You have to be particularly fast to get in. So first of all, it's hard to get in, and then the route is challenging. There was a really difficult Berlin Marathon this year, which is a very flat course, but it was obscenely hot.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
And that's a really kind of poor condition that you want. And I think that that's kind of the monopoly of running, is that you can't predict what will happen on the day. And that's
it could
the
be
risk.
Terrible weather. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. Or you could just wake up and not have a good day, which is the heartbreaking aspect of it. I think I would love to run New York Marathon. That's meant to be fantastic. I would love to run one in Valencia.
Listen, I have so much admiration for you and my son. Like, genuinely, I thought it was amazing what they were doing. I'm never going to do it because I'm just not built for that. But it was incredible. And I loved everyone had their names on their shirts. So everyone, just random people, just screaming their names, go on. I just thought it was a really nice event. It was absolutely incredible.
Yeah, so, I think the thing that people always forget when they're talking about marathons is that you can also train and get a lot of satisfaction out of racing shorter distances. This year, I haven't done a marathon, and I've really enjoyed signing up for 10Ks and trying to break down my 10K
your
time.
Strava bests.
Yeah, and 5Ks and you know, the half marathons, you can still get that runner's high and that satisfaction by putting in work, but for different distances.
That was Hannah Evans, the very impressive, very keen runner, but also the Times deputy food editor. Coming up, who is in the line of fire for Rachel Reeves' upcoming tax raid? But first, it's the news with James Kitchen.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you, Dom. Good afternoon. In the past half hour, the last remaining candidate to be named the chair of the grooming gangs inquiry has pulled out. The former police officer Jim Gamble has withdrawn from the process. It comes as the Prime Minister has promised not to water down the investigation after four survivors of the scandal quit the panel, complaining they're being ignored. Sir Keir Starmer's also defended the safeguarding minister Jess Phillips, as a number of survivors say they've lost faith in her. But the Home Affairs spokesperson for the Liberal Democrats, Max Wilkinson, doesn't think she should resign.
We must remember the victims, and if we're going to get to the point at which they have
regained trust in the system, we need to make sure that the government publishes those terms of reference in draft form, if they need to, as soon as they possibly can, and then get this inquiry off the ground.
The teenager who stabbed fellow pupil Harvey Wilgoose to death at a school in Sheffield has been named as Mohammed Umar Khan. He was found guilty of murder in August and will be sentenced this afternoon. Inflation has remained unchanged for the third month in a row thanks to easing food costs. The rate at which prices are rising stayed at 3.8% in September. A man who was deported to France as part of the one-in-one-out deal has returned to the UK on a small boat. The migrant's been detained by the Home Office and will be sent back to France. And five men have been charged after violence outside a hotel housing asylum seekers in Dublin. Bricks and fireworks were thrown at police, one of whom was injured. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
This is Times Radio.
Make sure you're ready for the hosting season with EE, the UK's fastest growing broadband provider. Get ultra reliable full fiber that can handle...
Mom, what's your Wi-Fi password?
I need to download my updates.
And so all the extra guests can...
stream films in the kitchen.
And go all out on gaming.
Hurry, order today to be ready for Christmas. We'll even make the switch easy with up to £300 towards your leaving fees.
Sounds simple.
Up to £300 credited to your EE account. Verify at ee.co.uk/claims. New customers, 62% availability, 24 months, terms apply.
Stop. Listen. Chicken. The 10 mini fillet bucket. £7.99. 10 succulent mini fillets. Buy. Eat. Digest. Good. Repeat. Get the deal. Believe in chicken.
KFC.
Until 9th of November. Subject to availability. Participating restaurants only. Excludes delivery. Full T's and C's at kfc.co.uk.
My dad was a fantastic builder. Plumbing, electrics, carpentry. There was nothing he couldn't do. But he's 83 now, and he can't do any of that stuff anymore. That's hard when you've always been so capable. Unfortunately, Mum died a couple of years ago now, so he does feel quite isolated. Huh. At least he did until Kerry arrived. She's been amazing. She's Dad's care professional from Home Instead. They provide the best quality care in your own home. Dad'll never want to leave that cottage. Well, he restored it practically from scratch, all on his own. We all pop over to see him whenever we can, but we've all got busy lives. So it's real peace of mind that Kerry can be there when we're not. She helps him with all the things he can't do for himself anymore. But we've told her the only thing she's allowed to do relating to building is make Dad's favourite builder's brew.
For award-winning home care you can trust, go to homeinstead.co.uk.
When you're growing a small business, you need someone who understands the ins and outs. And whether you're a tailor... or an accountant, you need the tools to succeed. With an HSBC Small Business Banking account, you'll have free accounting tools and access to our business specialists, virtually or in person. Because whatever your small business looks like, we're with you all the way. Search HSBC Small Business Banking account to get started. Subject to application, eligibility, credit check and T's and C's. Visit hsbc.co.uk for details.
Get the day's politics, business and sport every weekday in breakfast from 6:30 a.m.
Weekday afternoons on Times Radio with Wix. Ready to start planning your new kitchen or bathroom? If you'd like a personalised design, the Wix free design service can guide you through the whole process, including a free home measure. Book today at wix.co.uk.
Welcome back. I'm Dom Jolly in for Jane and Fee. And every day at this time, apparently, John Pienaar comes in to tell us what he's got coming up on his show. And here he is, like clockwork. John, what can we look forward to?
Hello, Dom. So I'm going to be looking at a lot of things. I mean, just where are we with the Grooming Gang inquiry, of course. Now, the other candidate to chair that inquiry, Jim Gamble, former police officer, he's dropped out. So Keir Starmer says he's going to get this right, and he's going to keep on having to try to get this right. And that's going to be, you know, potentially hard work, given the different issues that he's got to balance. But I'm talking about that. I'm talking also about the war in Ukraine. I mean, so much has happened in so short a time, which is generally the way with that story. We've seen the prospects of talks, whatever they may have been worth or what little they may have been worth between Donald Trump and Putin in Hungary. That's not going to happen now.
Was that because he just couldn't fly there? Or?
clearly, it was, from what we've seen, it's because Putin has been consistent. He hasn't changed his mind, although Donald Trump, it changes his mind, it seems, as often as the wind changes.
And Donald Trump falls for it every time.
Well, it seems to, if that's, yeah. That's what's going on. So now that there's no talks, and now Putin is sticking to the plan of wanting all of victory in Ukraine. Will Trump change his mind again? Will he spin on his heel and suddenly sound more
I can't see Trump
Ukraine?
Changing his mind. He's not that kind of guy.
No, exactly. He's just, he's a model of constancy, isn't he? I'm also looking at the so-called Coalition of the Willing and talking to an Estonian former commander of the army there, and Kira Rudik, one of the Ukrainian MPs, and a great deal else beside, John.
Sounds amazing. Look forward to it. That'll be John Pienaar coming up at 4 o'clock. Now back to today. The Times reports that lawyers, accountants and perhaps family doctors are in Rachel Reeves' crosshairs. That story is from The State of It, the new podcast by The Times and Sunday Times. You can also read it in the paper, which says that the Chancellor is planning a £2 billion tax raid as part of her budget aimed at people who use limited liability partnerships, LLPs, I think they're known as. Andrew Sanford is a partner at the tax firm Blick Rothenberg. Andrew, firstly, I mean, what is a limited liability partnership?
Good afternoon, Dom.
Good afternoon.
A limited liability partnership is a vehicle which affords partners limited liability. So that means risking them being sued. Or preventing them being sued potentially.
Yeah.
But also, it effectively affords a self-employed status. And a self-employed status means that they do not currently pay employers' national insurance.
Oh, I see. So what you're doing is you're being an incredibly well-paid lawyer, but pretending to be freelance as well. You've got best of both worlds.
Well, it's not so much freelance, but you've still obviously got employees. But you don't the LLP doesn't have to bear employers' national insurance like a company would. So I'm employed by a company, and company pays employers' national insurance on my salary. Whereas if you're a partner in a partnership, that doesn't happen.
So if Rachel, you know, if this is true, and Rachel Reeves is coming for LLPs, how many people will this affect?
Well, it will affect a large number of lawyers, as is mentioned, people in the financial services, doctors, and generally those professions where you traditionally associate with a partnership. Having said that, you mentioned that it potentially raise £2 billion. Of course, that is just 1/15th of the amount that she needs to raise to cover her black hole.
What sort of cost do you think she will be able to raise on this? I mean, is it realistic?
£2 billion could be realistic, but lawyers and highly paid professionals will look to seek to mitigate their liabilities. So they could, for example, consider incorporating a company and thus deferring paying the tax. They may also consider, is it worth being in the UK at all? Could they practice their trade overseas, which could happen in certain industries, particularly financial services, and that could have a material effect on the output from those sectors in our economy. If you like, with the rise in employers' national insurance, we again saw how that affected the economy. So I've got a great degree of nervousness about what is being proposed here.
So are we to expect a whole lot of accountants and lawyers to be getting on dinghies and fleeing to France?
I don't think it would be quite as quick as that, no, not at all. But what you would expect is maybe them to consider, as I mentioned earlier, incorporating a company, thus deferring paying the tax. Also, bear in mind, lawyers and doctors employ people, and they've got additional costs. They may not be able to pass on the salary increases to their staff as much, and also can then put on the cost to the end customer in certain circumstances. So it won't only just be the higher paid professionals who could be affected, it could be other taxpayers as well.
Andrew Sanford there, professional partnership specialist at Blick Rothenberg. Now I have to say, this is a story that caught my eye today. Country Life is the Bible of the barber-clad classes. It's also, it turns out, one of the great mainstays of David Beckham's life. And he's guest edited the magazine's latest edition and says a copy of it would travel with him whenever he played away from home. Well, maybe we should rewrite that. But so what can readers expect? Mark Hedges is Country Life's editor-in-chief. Good afternoon, Mark.
Hi, Dom. How are you?
I'm very good. I have to admit, I live in the country. I've perused Country Life occasionally, but normally it's property porn, really. You look at large, massive country houses at the beginning. I'm assuming that maybe is what attracts David Beckham. What makes this edition different to others? I mean, who have you had any other guest editors before David Beckham?
We had the King a couple of times and
That
Queen
makes
Camilla.
Sense.
So we've done it before, but not very often.
You haven't had a gold embossed edition though, have you? Who's next? Donald Trump?
No, I think I can safely say that's probably quite unlikely, actually.
Oh, come on. I'd love to see that.
Unless it takes us over. I don't know.
Seriously, though, I mean, David Beckham famously, I mean, I've now watched the second massive documentary series on his family, so I'm well aware that he has this place near me in the Cotswolds, and he has his barns and his bees and his flowers and his cooking. But why did you go for David Beckham?
Well, I met him at a lunch, and I didn't really know him at all. And we got chatting. I don't know, as he did really quite like the countryside. He, you know, he was part of it. That was where he sort of went for his solace. And he was also quite good fun. My brother-in-law is a great Man United fan and has a tremendous number of tattoos of Man United heroes from the past. But they're particularly badly done on Tim. And I got him to pose next to my shoulders so that Tim could get a better one. And we sort of struck it off. I thought he was, you know, really good fun. He's a man who could pretty much do anything. He could spend his money however he wants. But he's chosen to make the most of the British countryside. And country life is all about the British countryside. And I think it's rather remarkable how much it's come to mean to him, and that is where he finds his peace and solace with his family.
I read the article and the interview, if you like, and I did enjoy it. And I think it's clear he is serious about certain things. You know, the bees seems to be very into his bees and flowers and growing things and the peace of the countryside. But I think people might possibly struggle to picture him as the countryside gent that you're used to seeing in country life. Some might even say, I mean, I live in the Cotswolds, and I have to say, it feels a little bit like he's cosplaying occasionally, wandering around in tweed caps and tweed jackets. It's not really the Cotswolds, or is it?
Well, I don't know. I used to live in the Cotswolds before you moved in, Dom.
Well, and most people left when I moved in.
I don't know if they were connected. I'm glad that. And the Cotswolds has obviously very much changed from, you know, I was there 40-odd years ago.
The good old days.
Yeah, it's a different sort of place. I think, you know, he, I mean, I know that he does wear this stuff. He has, I mean, you know, when you go into his house, there's so many of these sort of sticks and hats and everything all hanging up there that he, you know, he loved Peaky Blinders.
Well, that's what I was saying. It felt like a sort of posh Peaky Blinders.
Well, I mean, maybe it is, but, it doesn't matter. You know, no. In the end, the countryside's too precious for to get ignored. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't really, everyone loves countryside. You know, it's hugely popular. It's part of our DNA of being British. It sadly doesn't have many votes in it. So the government sort of tends to ignore it. But actually all the people who live in Britain are rather fond of it. And, I was terribly keen editing Country Life that we got another sort of icon who wanted to celebrate how amazing the countryside is.
I think it's a very smart move. And I think genuinely, I mean, the countryside has always been about people coming down from London and falling in love with it and then kind of keeping it going, really. And he's putting money into the countryside. And I think he genuinely does seem to enjoy that sort of stuff. I'm not a purist in any way at all. I was a little surprised by a gold embossed magazine. What was the choice behind that?
Well, I mean, to be honest, it's probably a very regal thing. We started doing it when I got the King when he was the Prince of Wales in 2013. Then he did it another time, and then when Queen Camilla did it, it felt sort of churlish not to give the new knight the same treatment.
So how long have you known him? So he gave some of his honey, I think, to the king. Is that right?
Yeah, no, I believe he did, and I think they swapped honey, I'm told. But
they're honey smugglers.
Oh no, exactly. I've known him I met him maybe 3 or 4 years ago, this today actually is my 1,000th issue of editing Country Life, which is quite a lot. And I thought, rather like Fee and Jane, I'd have the week off and get somebody else to do it.
There you go. So I came up from the country to do it. I remember reading when I'd go and stay with friends in the Cotswolds, actually, when I was a teenager or whatever, the bathrooms of their parents' houses would always be just have stacks of Country Life. And really, even back then, it was a kind of, you'd look at those first sort of 10, 20 pages of massive country piles and you think, one day. Do you think that's what attracted, because David Beckham claims that he bought a copy of The Match, which I'm not aware of, but is obviously a football magazine, and Country Life, even when he was playing football.
That's what he told me, yeah, no, I mean.
Do you believe him?
I do, actually. He's an incredibly nice man.
Yes, I know. He clearly has charmed you. But there's a bit in the article where I think his son goes, "Where are you going, Dad? Are you coming to London?" And he goes, "No, I'm not. I'm being interviewed by Country Life." And then his son goes, "Why, that's your favourite magazine, son." It sounded a little bit unreal, but I'm willing to believe it.
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, sometimes you have to take quotes as you're given them.
Yeah, of course.
And he, you know, he does say that. He does genuinely absolutely adore Country Life. I don't, you know, I think it's just great for the magazine that he does. It's even greater for the countryside. And that's the whole reason for having this bit of fun and doing it. And
I agree with
getting
that.
Getting the countryside talked about.
Did you meet Lady Beckham? Did he meet
No, I've
Posh?
Never had that pleasure.
Do
I've
we get? I get the slight feeling that Posh might be a little less keen on the countryside, more of a townie than Sir David.
All I know is that he didn't want to buy somewhere too far away from London, and you can read into that what you want.
Yeah, I can see that. So does he? Do we know how he gets down? Because he lives in Holland Park, doesn't he? So
yeah, no, he drives
does he,
down.
Does he does he suffer? Does he suffer the A40? The rest of us, or is he helicopter down?
He drives down with his spaniels and
is that a euphemism?
No. He drives down with his three spaniels and. And apparently that's, you know, he goes down on a Friday and most weeks, and then he spends the weekend there and either comes back on a Sunday. You know, the amazing thing about it is he's an incredibly busy man. I think it's rather impressive that a person who clearly doesn't need to work for money is actually working as hard as he's ever done in his life.
Now, I don't want to put you on the spot here, but I judge a man by what he calls his dogs. Do you know what David Beckham's dogs are called?
I do, and I should know.
I'm genuinely not putting you on the spot. I'm just interested.
No,
Gary Neville, I believe, is one. I've made that up.
No. They're called things like Olive.
Oh, okay. So they're quite soft. Yeah.
Are
you Googling now? Go on.
Racing through the pages to see if I can answer a question, but it's a huge issue.
It is a huge issue. Did you interview the dogs?
Oh, no, here we go. Here are the names. They are...
Here we go. It's exclusive here, everybody.
Sage,
that's nice.
And Olive, I don't know what the other two are called.
Olive, probably Parsley and Thyme, I would imagine. They're named after Simon and Garfunkel lyrics, I think is what we're talking about.
That's nothing wrong with that.
No, absolutely not.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed that. I think it's brilliant. I do love Country Life. I never managed to get one of the massive piles, but you never know. You never know. I'm still working for it, but I think it's brilliant. Well done on your 1,000th edition.
Thanks, Tom.
Brilliant. That was the editor, Country Life's editor-in-chief, Mark Hedges, there telling me about his 1,000th edition and having Sir David Beckham as the guest editor. My, the country's gone to the dogs, hasn't it? No, I'm sure it hasn't. Coming up, The Traitors is taking over the world, but a new interview in The Times reveals it nearly never got off the ground. That and more in our TV news next. It's 2:49. This is Dom Jolly on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
The evening edition on Times Radio with the new Volkswagen California camper van. Embark on an evening expedition, rounding up the latest news and previewing tomorrow's headlines. Plus, don't miss Hit the Road, your essential weekly travel guide to the best destinations across the UK and beyond. Every Monday to Thursday night from 7 on Times Radio with the new Volkswagen California camper van. Designed for every adventure. Search New Volkswagen California to find out more.
Download the free Times Radio app and listen to us wherever you are.
Stop. Listen. Chicken. The 10 mini fillet bucket. $7.99. 10 succulent mini fillets. Buy. Eat. Digest. Good. Repeat. Get the deal. Believe in chicken. KFC. Until 9th of November, subject to availability. Participating restaurants only. Excludes delivery. Full T's and C's at kfc.co.uk.
This is Times Radio.
Welcome back. This is Dom Jolly here on Times Radio, in for Jane and Fee. I'm still getting over the whole Country Life thing and David Beckham. Apparently, someone tells me here, Joe Beaumont, they're called Fig, Sage and Olive, his three dogs. I quite like Fig, not too keen on Sage and Olive. But then someone said, "Lot, you know way too much about his dogs." That's the Spaniels. Apparently, he has a cockapoo, Simba, and GSD Logan, which sounds like an action figure. I don't know what that is at all. Nothing will beat my neighbour in Cheltenham, whose dog, I'm afraid, recently died, sadly, a very old, angry dog, and he went by the name of Traitor. And every morning I'd be awoken to the sound of this man screaming for his dog, Traitor, Traitor, over Pitfield. But there you go. My dogs are called Fitzgerald and Truman. That's a proper dog's name. Come on, two dogs there. Anyway, this is Dom Jolly, as I said, here for Times Radio, in for Jane and Fee, and we are going to talk telly. Celebrity Traitors returns to our screens tonight, bringing no doubt more viral moments of Alan Carr getting away with just totally blowing his cover. And rather wonderfully, Celia Imrie breaking wind more. It's what we need. These have been the moments of telly so far this year. It was almost never made, though. The Times has been speaking to the Dutch documentary maker, credited with inventing the show, about how he struggled for 5 years to persuade his nation's broadcasters to take it on. Let's discuss all these incredibly important matters with TV critic Scott Bryan. Hello, Scott.
Hello, you right?
I'm very good. I can't wait to get in on this. I'm loving Celebrity Traitors, especially as I went to do a Traitors live experience. I wasn't famous enough to do the real deal, but I was sent to Covent Garden to sit in what sort of felt like a glorified escape room, and I thought I was going to hate it. But I have to say, once you're kind of into it, you realise the tactics that you need. I mean, essentially, shut up. Go below the radar. So obviously I was chucked out first immediately, but it was quite interesting. Are you as obsessed with Celebrity Traitors as I am?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I think the Celebrity series has managed to retain what the main Civilian series has.
Civilian, I love that.
Yeah, such adoration for, whilst also, I think, kind of having that different dynamic of having celebrities, because as you know, celebrities, I think, are some of the most competitive people in the world. So I think it kind of allows them to be sort of throwing in. And I think also the fact that they are all invested in the show format, I think an anxiety when you had such A-listers attached to it, I think would be whether they would not really play the game sort of with their full sort of intention.
We've had no hissy fits yet, really, have we?
No.
I was wondering. And apparently they do get taken away at the end of every day. They get taken away to what's described as a reasonably budgeted hotel where they are cut off from the rest of the world, so they can't look up other people and see if they're lying. Do we believe this?
I mean, this is the case that they sort of, they stay near Inverness Airport. I mean, I think the fact that the show has to be sort of thorough in the way that they sort of can't let up to any of the people participating that, you know, what might be actually really happening. I think a reason for its success is that Studio Lambert, who make this, they also do Squid Game for Challenge, they also do Gogglebox, I think are really trusted in reality TV of sort of putting their heart and a real investment into making sure that the format is watertight. Sort of Stephen Lambert is known within the entire industry for being this sort of genius format creator who's able to sort of make things really work and resonate with the public. And I think for Traitors, although an adaptation of a Belgian format, is sort of the latest in a long line that he's been able to do. I think it's just the fact that it's all of these little moments, I think, in the show and why it works so well. I think in the Civilian series, a risk is just that everyone was becoming a bit too self-interested and therefore it wouldn't sort of have that sort of positive vibe, that camaraderie that sometimes happens. But you're getting it in the bucket load with the Celebrity version. And I think it's also those little moments, like Celia Emery. I mean, who would have thought that she would be the breakout star, even though she's already a big star.
Yeah, I mean, there are lots of flaws, I think, with the celebrity thing. I mean, firstly, just the fact that people know each other before, you know, a lot of people know each other already before they go in. So there tend to be natural alliances. And whether you like it or not, there is a strata of celebritydom, and you kind of feel they can't really go for the very sort of least famous because it feels cruel. Stephen Fry appears to be untouchable because everyone just wants to spend as long as possible with Stephen Fry. So they kind of go for the middle ranking ones, although I have a feeling Jonathan Ross is probably in trouble and deservedly so.
I think so. I think he is certainly the one who's at risk the most so far. I think it was amazing that he managed to get through last Thursday's episode, to
it's
be honest.
It's amazing that he employs whoever dresses him, to be honest. I mean, it's incredible.
I mean, it was when he came out in this sort of Flintstones outfit.
That was unbelievable.
And Alan Carr said, yabba dabba don't, was the line for me of the whole series.
I totally agree. Got rid of some really good people as well. I've forgotten her name, but the sort of goth girl who, you know, as an ex-goth, I loved her. And she absolutely took on Jonathan Ross. She broke the hierarchy. I thought she was amazing.
Yes, same here. But I think also, like you were saying about the most popular celebrity leaves first, I think a real challenge is that actually is that some of the sort of the people participating are such household names. It feels rather unbelievable that some of the people who will be leaving over the course of the next 2 days, and that there's only really sort of, I think, about five or six more episodes left, I think five. So I think, you know, maybe the BBC's wishes is actually the show was a little bit longer.
Well, they should have gone for it. I wish our chat on this was longer, because I could talk about this for a week, but we've got some other stuff to talk about. Of course, Traitors out tonight and tomorrow night, so I can't wait for that. Now, there's also a TV adaptation of the Ronan Hessian novel Leonard and Hungry Paul out on BBC One. I know nothing about this apart from the fact that Julia Roberts was a fan. Is that right?
Yes, and she's actually come on board. I mean, I think a lot of people would be sort of piqued in their interest because of the fact that she's the narrator of this series.
And in an Irish drama. Does she
in
fit?
An Irish drama. But she said that she's a big fan of it. And of course, if you get an email to say, yes, Julia Roberts can help narrate your series, you're not going to say no, are you?
No, even if she says, I really want to do this as a sort of Finnish person. Like, yeah, whatever you want, Julia.
But Ronan Hessian, I mean, the book has had acclaim because it's a bit of an antidote, I think, to a lot of sort of comedy and shows at the moment where everything is always quite high stakes, where with this book, it's pretty low stakes, really. I mean, it starts on a sad note with a character losing his mother. But then from that point onwards, it's all about him asking out somebody for a date, essentially, whilst his friend, who he always plays board games with, is a potential winner of a competition for a company. But it's the fact that this TV adaptation, which is called Leonard and Hungry Paul, it's on BBC Two, all of the episodes are available. I think it's a fact that it manages, I think, to have, firstly, great writing. I mean, it's really well written, and I think it's the humour manages to hit the right tone of it not becoming too twee. But I think it's also like a celebration of sometimes taking a step back rather than taking light leaning in. I think also the fact that it's really well acted. Alex Lawther's been in lots of things recently, including the new Alien Earth. Lloyd Kinaston, who you'll also recognise, has been in, I think, some BBC Two sitcoms. He's been playing on the West End as well. I think their dynamic throughout this series is also great to watch.
Scott, Brian, we're run out of time, sadly. I really wanted to talk about the thing I watched, Mr. Nobody Against Putin, which is an incredible documentary, and if you can catch that, do. But thank you very much for talking telly with me. Traitors on tonight.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
It is 3 o'clock and you're listening to Dom Jolly on Times Radio, in for Jane and Fee. Coming up in the next hour, could Keir Starmer's migrant plan finally get off the ground? We'll hear about the summit he's hosting here in London. Water companies that fill our rivers with sewage face bigger and faster fines under new government plans. I'll speak to a campaigner. The Jaguar Land Rover hack has cost £2 billion. We'll talk tech news with our expert Chris Stokel-Walker. And my big interview, I'm so excited, is with the Veep star Tony Hale on his new film Sketch. But first, it's the headlines with James Kitchen.
Thank you, Tom. Good afternoon. The government says it's disappointed after the frontrunner to be named chair of the grooming gang's inquiry pulled out. The former police officer Jim Gamble has withdrawn, saying survivors deserve better. The Home Office has blamed the intensity of the process. Earlier, Kemi Badenoch accused the government of launching a briefing war against survivors after four resigned from the inquiry panel. One alleged a toxic environment, while another feared perpetrators' racial and religious motivations would be downplayed. The Prime Minister repeated that the investigation won't be watered down. Speaking to Times Radio, the police and crime commentator Danny Shaw described Mr. Gamble's withdrawal as a huge blow.
He's carried out a number of independent reviews and inquiries into safeguarding concerns and child protection issues. And if anyone thinks that he would be sort of you know, a patsy for the government or for the police service. They're very much mistaken. Jim Gamble's hugely independent, fiercely sort of guards his independence, and he will speak truth to power. So personally, I think it's a real shame that he's pulled out.
A judge in Sheffield has allowed the identification of the killer of the teenager Harvey Wilgoose. The 15-year-old was stabbed in the heart by Muhammad Umar Khan at school in front of other students in February. Khan was found guilty of murder in August and will be sentenced this afternoon. Reporter Katerina Vitozzi, who's outside Sheffield Crown Court, says the attack was chilling.
We know that Umar Khan, as he was referred to during the trial here, brought a 13-centimetre hunting knife into school with him that day. And in an attack which happened just outside the school canteen, in just two blows, he fatally stabbed Harvey Wilgoose.
Volodymyr Zelensky is backing Donald Trump's plan for the conflict in Ukraine to freeze at the current front lines. The Ukrainian leader says it would be a good compromise, but doesn't think the Russian president, Vladimir Putin, would support it. Last night, Kiev used British Storm Shadow missiles in what it called a massive attack on an explosives plant in western Russia. The defence analyst Michael Clark says Ukraine is sending this message to the White House.
We're not beaten. We are able to keep on fighting and look at what sort of pressure we can build on Russia, not just on the Russian economy into next year, which is what they're trying to do with hitting the refineries in Russia, but also on Russia's war-making capacity.
A man who was deported to France as part of the one-in-one-out deal has returned to the UK on a small boat. The migrant told The Guardian he was a victim of modern slavery at the hands of smugglers in northern France. It's understood he's been detained by the Home Office and will be sent back across the Channel. And for the third month in a row, the rate at which prices are rising has stayed the same. Inflation was at 3.8% in September, below what many economists had expected, but still well above the Bank of England's 2% target. A rise in fuel costs was balanced by lower food prices, but butchery manager Beth Jacob says the way people shop is constantly changing.
I think people are just changing their spending habits. So we would have people come in every week. Mm-hmm. They might now come in every 2 or 3 weeks. So they're eating less, but they still want to eat high quality when they do eat it.
And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on the Times radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. Weekday afternoons on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms.
Welcome back. You're listening to me, Dom Jolly, sitting in for Jane and Fee on Times Radio. Now, a quarter of small boat migrants who reach the UK have travelled through the Balkans, and that alone might explain why Keir Starmer is hosting a summit with Balkan leaders today with hopes of a returns deal. But it's far from the only item on the agenda. Fending off Russian influence in the region and tackling the illegal drugs trade are also on the agenda. Dr. Andy Hodgi, OBE, lecturer in law at King's College London and an associated fellow at the Royal United Institute for Security and Defence, joins me now. Hello, Doctor.
Hello, it's lovely to be with you.
Thank you very much. Why do migrants take this route from the Balkans?
Well, I think we have to look at the studies, but what we know, in particular from the last wave of migration in 2015, some of the migrants will take the Western Balkan or the Balkan route, as is known, which is coming from Turkey to Greece, and then they pass through North Macedonia, Bulgaria, and then get into mainland Europe. So that has been one of the routes. But then we also have other routes, which is through the Mediterranean Sea, and then they reach either Spain or Portugal.
And what stopped action or the government taking action in the past?
So what has happened in the past is that Frontex, which is an agency that looks at the European border security, signed a deal with the countries of the Western Balkan, and they changed the treaties, where now the border patrol is shared with Frontex. And that has helped in terms of cutting down on some of the crossing in the Balkan and kind of making a preventive route.
So the UK has just announced that it'll support peacekeeping in Kosovo for another 3 years at least. And then yesterday, Kosovan leaders said they might help with Starmer's plan for migrant return hubs. That doesn't seem like much of a coincidence to me.
Well, Keir Starmer is in discussion with a number of the Western Balkan countries for a return hub. And pretty much the summit, if you want to sum it up, it's sort of a shopping opportunity for Starmer to try and convince one of the Western Balkans countries for a return hub. Now, in the past, we have seen the UK government trying to approach different countries, but one, we have to have a clear objective as to why Keir Starmer wants to do a return hub after Rwanda. And he has to give quite clear indication as to why one of the Western Balkan countries would be a preferred option. Now, given that, there is a lot of political complexity. So having discussed with some of the leaders of the Western Balkans, we had a number of side events yesterday ahead of the summit. A number of them were pretty tired when it came to discussing migration because they viewed migration as a UK problem and it's not their problem. So in that sense, if you are approaching the Western Balkans and say, well, we're going to help you with security, which security threat is one of the key issues that they are facing, then there is something in the table to negotiate. And then we will see the details later on when Keir Starmer meets at 4:35 with some of the Western Balkan leaders.
So there are a couple of sort of individual deals, but what's the prospect of a broad deal?
I think it will be very unlikely to have because we are going to talk about what is it that the Western Balkans are getting in return. Now, the Western Balkans, as a political vision, they would like to join the European Union. Now, the UK doesn't have any more say whether they can join the European Union or not. And half of them are already members of NATO. So it's not much that the UK can give in return. However, if Keir Starmer and the UK government is clever enough to show that actually we want to have a more continuous relation with the Western Balkans, not only when it suits us, then maybe there is something there to be discussed.
And regarding fears about Russia, how much influence does Russia have in the Balkans?
So the measurement, it's difficult to make, but what is quite clear is that Russia has influence in the Western Balkans. It has in Serbia an offsite where it's supposedly or illegally called as a humanitarian center, but that is just an offsite for the Russian spy ring and how they operate in the rest of the Western Balkans. And then in particular, in Serbia and in Bosnia, the influence is very, very deep. And then in some other parts of the Western Balkans, it's less, but it's still present. And what Russia has done very much in the since the war in Ukraine, it has opened a number of their media outlets, such as Sputnik at Russia Today in a number of the Western Balkan countries. And with the U.S. sort of retrieving from the Western Balkans, largely the world, in terms of investing on media and other soft powers, Russia as well as China has stepped in. So that's another opportunity that it's going to be discussed today at the summit. And if the UK could show some willingness or support for the wider the support of the Western Balkan security, then that's something that would be very much welcomed.
So, I mean, are there any practical things that they're thinking of doing to counter Russia's influence?
One of them is to have a more set up a reinforcement and some of the peacekeeping missions, and because some of them, they do have an agreement similar to one that we are trying to provide to Ukraine. So that is one indication that they could help. Another one is to share intelligence between the UK in terms of finding out earlier who is trying to influence the Western Balkans, what sort of activities they are doing. And the third one, which a number of the Western Balkans would be very interested in, is to have the UK invest more in their security procurement. Now, with Keir Starmer opening this new debate about reinvesting in the UK when it comes to arms, the Western Balkans could be one of those partners that some of these companies could be developed and provide those support.
And finally, the drugs trade is on the agenda too. How big a problem is that in the Balkans?
In the Western Balkans, it's not a big issue. It's more of an issue for the rest of the EU. Now, the Western Balkans have been suggested in the past that organized crime does facilitate some of the drug trade. but the majority of it is actually happening in mainland Europe. So there will be discussion around how can we have joint operation to identify organized crime networks from the beginning and to try to share those intelligence so those can be disrupted. However, a more wider policy has to be discussed when it comes to drug prevention because, you know, one of the main contributors to having a drug problem is because we have a high number of consumption.
Dr. Andy Hodgi there. And some breaking news. The number of migrants who have arrived in the UK so far this year after crossing the English Channel has passed the total for the whole of 2024. Just looking at some of your messages here, looking back to when we were chatting about marathons. This is from Robbie. Marathon addiction is real. And for me, it's something people use to escape other addictions or pain. For me, that was escaping alcoholism. And I've run 173 marathons now. Jane said, I started running at age 64, ran my first marathon just after lockdown. I've since run 7 marathons, 3 ultra marathons, including one I ran on Sunday with acute plantar fasciitis. I don't think I said that right, but that just sounds like a horrible feat. Caroline, I love running. Just started clean boot hunting, where bloodhounds and horses and riders chase humans. What? Now that's a marathon. Are you sure this isn't the Hunger Games you've joined there, Caroline? 6 a.m. start today for a run through the Suffolk farmland. Okay, well, I'm feeling a new TV format there. Mary Spillane, marathoners give up when their knees scream stop. I mourned the loss when I had to stop with 12 marathons under my belt. A couple of people about David Beckham. Beckham lives in the Cotswolds, but in the grounds of Soho Farmhouse, for good sake. In a newly built house. It's all fake. What else have we got? Oh, The Times. We had a cat called Shackleton. A bit ironic that he hated snow, though. That's from Roger. Thank you very much for your messages, and do keep getting in touch if you would like me to read your messages out. Now, coming up after 3:30, the Emmy-winning Veep actor Tony Hale on his new film Sketch. And a reminder, if you enjoy Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio in the afternoons, and why wouldn't you, then you can get even more Jane and Fee with their podcast Off Air. All of their 3:30 p.m. interviews are available in full too. They've spoken to Rick Astley, Ian McEwan and Lise Doucet. Yesterday, they spoke to Amy Wallace, co-writer of Virginia Giuffre's memoir Nobody's Girl, and she discusses the book and the life of Giuffre. She told Jane Garvey that Prince Andrew should lead the charge by sharing everything he knows about Jeffrey Epstein with investigators.
If he does care about that, I think there is more room for him to be more active. And by which I mean, this is a man. Well, let's leave aside what he does or does not admit to. He was in those houses. He was on that island. He was on the jets. Those jets were remodeled to have a lot of bedrooms. That was the entire way. They were gutted inside and then bedrooms. They were places to traffic girls. So he saw things that were going on. And if he cares so deeply about this, he could share that information with investigators. This is what happened. Let me validate their experience.
You can download that and many, many, many other episodes wherever you get your podcasts from. Now, fining England's water companies for sewage spills could soon get quicker and easier under new government plans, which could see firms face automatic fines of up to £20,000 for minor breaches, with tougher action for serious cases. It comes as the industry's biggest player, Thames Water, faces financial pressure, delaying its challenge to bill limits while it searches for a buyer. I'm joined now by Ash Smith, founder of Windrush Against Sewage Pollution. Good afternoon, Ash.
Hi.
By Windrush, do you mean the River Windrush?
Yes, I do, in Oxfordshire and Gloucestershire.
Is it bad? Because I've swum in it.
Oh, you know, you don't want to do that these days.
Oh, no.
It's horrible, unfortunately. It was a thing of great beauty, and now it is a terrible shadow. There's still fish in it.
No more swimming for me. When it comes to sewage spills, we know the rules are broken so often. Do you think these proposed changes really make a difference?
Okay, so this is what governments do when they don't really want to deal with the problem, which is privatised water. Because privatised water is all about making money from the system and not delivering the service. So the same sort of thing was put out by the Conservative government at the end of 2023. In fact, it was exactly the same thing. It was bringing in penalties that would be easier to issue, etc., etc. You can guess how many were issued. One. Did it make any difference? No. Will this make any difference? No. And the fundamental reason for that is there's only one source of money for the water industry, and that is you and I and all the other bill payers. There is no other money. There's no private investment. That's just an illusion. So the fines, they're going to be paid by us anyway. So is that going to make any difference to the water industry? Absolutely not.
And it seems that the system's largely going to address minor offences rather than the big serious ones.
Well, they talk about lowering the burden of proof to the civil balance of probabilities rather than beyond reasonable doubt. Well, water industries are going to argue that very hard in court if it's anything significant. Otherwise, they're just going to pay token fines that we know are just all about keeping pollution profitable and will make zero impact. But this does give government a little bit of breathing space, and there will be other organisations, charities and NGOs saying, oh, this looks promising, when they've fallen for the same nonsense before. And they should really wake up and say, there's enough of this now. Let's take back control of the water industry into public ownership and start doing the job properly for people, for the environment and for the people who work for those companies as well.
Is there a way that people, you know, wild swimmers, which I occasionally do, can find out how polluted their local river is? A bit late for me in the case of the Windrush, but is there somewhere they can go and find that out?
Well, the difficulty is that a lot of pollution comes from treated sewage, effluent as well. So that puts a lot of bacteria into waterways, some of which can be resistant bacteria. So yeah, I wouldn't like to guarantee anything, but you can tell much more now when sewage companies are dumping untreated sewage, because there are maps like sewagemap.co.uk, which is an easy thing to remember,
yeah,
that will show you live when untreated sewage is maybe being put into the river upstream of where you were thinking of going for a dip.
Well, I don't know if I'm going to now, but thank you very much. That was Ash Smith, founder of Windrush Against Sewage Pollution. Don't forget, you can get in touch with the show. You can WhatsApp us on 0333 003 2353. You can tweet using the hashtag. Does anyone tweet anymore? I suppose you can't X, but tweet using the hashtag Times Radio. Coming up, we have all the latest news in the world of tech. It is 3:18, and this is Dom Jolly on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
Stayshore. What is Stayshore? Stayshore is not just the UK's favourite travel insurance. Stayshore is the confidence that comes with knowing that you're covered by the company with more five-star reviews on Trustpilot than any other provider. A company that welcomes people of all ages with pre-existing medical conditions for single or multiple trips. So Stayshore with Stayshore Travel Insurance. UK's favourite relates to number of five-star Trustpilot reviews, T's and C's and verifications at stayshore.co.uk/reviews.
You never forget the dogs you've loved. They have the power to steal our hearts, to love us unconditionally and be there for us when we need them most without saying a word. You understand how a dog can change a life. A guide dog can transform the life of someone living with sight loss. Will you help change someone else's life with a gift in your will to guide dogs? Request our free will guide today. Search Guide Dogs Free Wills.
Guide dogs. We travel to explore, to learn, to connect. At Viking, we believe travel should be more than just a trip. It should be a doorway to cultural insight and personal enrichment. Our itineraries are designed to help you explore and engage with your destination through its food, culture, and customs. Start planning your river, ocean, or expedition journey today. Viking, exploring the world in comfort. Learn more at viking.com.
Listen to Times Radio on your smart speaker. Just say, play Times Radio.
Weekday afternoons on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms, helping create rooms to feel proud of. From design consultants who'll measure your space and bring your vision to life on a 3D plan, through to a professional installation service. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Everything's computer.
That was Donald Trump, very short and concise. The overall cost of the Jaguar Land Rover cyber attack is estimated at nearly £2 billion, making it the single most financially damaging cyber event ever to hit the UK. More than 5,000 British businesses and organisations were affected by the hack, which caused JLR to suspend production for around 5 weeks. And depending on how long it takes the company to get back on its feet, the costs could rise even further. I'm joined now by tech journalist Chris Stokel-Walker. Chris, that is an enormous number. Where does most of the money end up going in these scenarios?
Yeah, absolutely astonishing, Dom. And unfortunately, I think large amounts of the money here that we're talking about in terms of that £1.6 to £2.1 billion is simply through lost businesses. So basically, JLR obviously were in the process of making vehicles, rolling many of them off their production lines pretty much constantly, found that actually they weren't necessarily able to do so as the production had to halt because their IT systems were so intrinsically linked to what they were doing. And obviously not just the impact, I suppose, on JLR there in terms of actually having to sort that out, but they have that huge number of reliable companies that basically need them to continue to do so. So this number is got at by saying basically around about 100 odd million pounds a week through not being able to actually do what you're doing and get the profit from that. Then it obviously has the element of having to fix things once they've gone wrong. So that is another 50 to 150 million pounds as well.
Do we have any idea who's responsible yet? I mean, it's not been a ransom thing, has it? It's been more just mischief making, but on a massive scale. I mean, is it the usual suspects?
It is, we believe, the usual suspects. There have been some claims of attribution here. We talked a little bit about them in previous weeks, the Scattered Lapse of Spider Group. They are a conglomeration, a kind of Avengers Assemble, but in the negative way of some of the worst hackers that are around. Although, you know, JLR is being really tight-lipped around whether or not this is ransomware or not, and also who exactly is behind it. So still to be really figured out, although it does bear some of the hallmarks of other things that we've seen in the past. And you know, cyber criminals like to claim responsibility for these sorts of things. Sometimes they are correct in claiming that, sometimes they may be not.
Are you hinting that it might be more state-sponsored, sort of Russia, North Korea?
Well, I don't think it's necessarily going to be to their benefit to do that. You know, we have, of course...
Why, they won't get their Land Rovers.
Well, exactly. Well, they've got larders and things like potentially instead.
Do we think it's them, though? I mean, it seems an odd thing to... I mean, it's such a massive thing that it does seem to have some sort of state backing.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, I think the reality is that you can cause absolute chaos from very small beginnings. So I would probably, if I was a betting person, I would suggest that this is more likely to be the non-state-sponsored hackers that are responsible for this. But, of course, we have heard in recent weeks, not least with the collapsed China spy trial, the allegations that have been made around China having access to very private information within the government, getting into those systems. What's interesting about that, Dom, is that actually, you know, China is basically trawling all of that information and hoovering it up, we believe, not knowing what is in it, because those messages, those communications have been encrypted, which means that they are not able to be seen by anybody other than the sender or the receiver, because they have effectively a kind of passcode that allows them to unlock the contents of that. But China is holding out hope that with the arrival of quantum computing, which is meant to be able to break through all of these defences much faster, that when that arrives, they'll be able to do so.
Kieran Martin, who's chair of the Cyber Monitoring Centre, is warning that the government's cybersecurity priorities are out of balance. I mean, what are they, and are they out of balance?
Yeah, Kieran Martin is also someone to listen to very much so. So he is obviously in charge of this now. He was in charge of the National Cybersecurity Centre, which was the government-affiliated body that oversees these sorts of things. He believes that we have this imbalance in terms of thinking constantly about personal data, and I understand why. We are all worried about this when these hacks occur, that our personal data has been breached and compromised. But he says that we need to be a little bit more realistic. Actually, we need a more honest conversation about the fact that there is going to be not just people trying to cause chaos and make meddling, but actually there are those who are making more severe threats against these sorts of things, disrupting our businesses, and that has a knock-on effect on our economy.
The former Deputy Prime Minister Nick Clegg has said that the valuations of AI companies are crackers while speaking at the Times Tech Summit. What did he mean by this?
I agree with Nick, I think, is probably what I would say. He means, obviously, that these sorts of things are in a bubble, and this is...
Is this like the dot-com bubble? It's all going to burst.
Well, it's going to burst, but not necessarily as significantly as the dot-com bubble, Dom. So there are these arguments to be said that this has echoes of the early 2000s when we saw monumental valuations for internet-based companies that then turned out to be not really rooted in reality. The result was, of course, a stock market crash and everything like that. There is a difference here, I suppose, with AI in that this is concentrated in only a very small number of companies, and rather than being very scrappy startups that are coming out of nowhere, they are incredibly well funded and often some of our biggest firms, so they can have the shoulders that can hold these sorts of impacts if they need to. Their shoulders are relatively broad. But I think that Nick Clegg is not necessarily wrong here, because many people have been saying that this is a little bit frothy, not least some of those within the AI businesses themselves. Sam Altman, the CEO of OpenAI, he has indicated that he thinks that there is too much excitement, too much hype, too many big valuations here. So it's just a case of when the bubble bursts, who will be lost and who will remain.
Nick Clegg also criticised the UK's dependency on American technology. Will this be a double agree with Nick?
It would be, and this is obviously interesting because he was speaking at the Times Tech Summit. He was speaking at a very apposite time. We had gone through the massive internet outage thanks to AWS. I was on Monday talking about that with Jane. And, you know, there is a real problem here, I suppose, with an over-reliance on American tech in any which way possible. So these big cloud computing providers that keep our apps, our services and our websites online, they are invariably, if not based in the United States in terms of their physical infrastructure, they are at least rooted in the United States in terms of where their companies are incorporated. And that is a big concern for governments, because obviously they don't want to be in hock to those US companies, not least because of the unpredictability of Donald Trump. And I think there is a concern here where maybe the UK is following in the footsteps of Europe, who are really worried about this and are developing what they call their own tech stack, the ability to continue their hardware in the event of some major outage a little bit closer to home.
Back to AI. I'm a total Luddite with this, so this is great for me. It's like I'm genning up. OpenAI has announced a new web browser called Atlas. So as the company seeks to expand into a broader platform, what changes would Atlas make to the practical experience of using the internet?
It would basically turn any search that you make currently. So maybe you type in a query to Google and you result in your links, and maybe you then look at the little AI summary that Google themselves are inserting, and it would actually make everything possible with AI. So you type in a query, instead you get entered into a conversation with ChatGPT. Perhaps you are on a website and there are those annoying boxes where you have to fill in with your name and your address and things like that. Rather than you having to type it out, you could just say to your web browser, to Atlas, well, I have, you know, this regular bit of information that I always have to put in. You know what it is. Please do it for me. Of course, that would be helpful and handy and good, but I think one of the challenges that OpenAI will face here, Dom, is that actually web browsers are very, very important things that we're very loath to switch easily. If we look back over the last 15 years of the history of the web browser, there have really only been two dominant forces. One of those initially was Microsoft's Internet Explorer, which was popular until around about 2010. Since then, the majority of people, around about 70%, are using what's called Google Chrome, and you're probably one of those two.
No, I'm not.
Users.
I'm DuckDuckGo.
Oh, well, you are a pro browser.
Thank you.
Pro browser user then.
I don't know why I'm on DuckDuckGo. I just am. Is that a good thing, bad thing?
Yeah, it's good. It's good. It means that you love animals. It means that you love.
Well, it's
privacy.
Got the word duck in it. That's the exciting thing for me.
Twice.
Yeah. Are there? I mean, with this stuff like Atlas and further AR, there are concerns around accuracy, aren't it? Considering it's well known that AI often gets its information wrong, is this going to just get better and better, or is that always going to be an issue?
It's always going to be an issue, in part because AI doesn't inherently know anything. I think as we get closer to users and as this becomes more common in our lives that we are using AI outputs, that becomes more of a concern. Interestingly, just today, the BBC and the European Broadcast Union, which is a collection of multiple state and state-sponsored broadcasters across Europe, they put out a report that suggested that AI-generated summaries of news reports are wrong 45% of the time. So if you start thinking about that, then you start thinking about the use of AI in our web browsers. It becomes a very confusing place for the veracity of information.
Chris Stokel-Walker, thank you very much for attempting to teach a Luddite something. But I'm still very pleased that I'm on DuckDuckGo, even though I don't know what that means. Coming up, the big interview with Tony Hale. I'm so excited. I'm such a massive Veep fan, and he did this film, which I watched, called Sketch, which is just really, really good, and I want to talk about it. But first, let's get a check on the latest news headlines with James Kitchen.
Across the UK, on DAB, online, and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you, Dom. Good afternoon. One of the frontrunners to become chair of the Grooming Gangs inquiry, Jim Gamble, has withdrawn. The former police officer's written a letter saying it's clear that a lack of confidence due to my previous occupation exists among some. Four survivors have withdrawn from the panel helping to establish the investigation over concerns about its focus, scope and trust in those leading it. Ellie Ann Reynolds is one of them and says it was a toxic environment.
We were told that we couldn't seek support from each other. We couldn't seek support from our general support networks. We weren't allowed to talk to family about it. We weren't allowed to even talk to each other on the panel about it.
Sir Starmer says he wants to get to the truth. A judge has ruled a boy who took a hunting knife to school and stabbed a teenager to death can be named. 15-year-old Mohammed Umar Khan killed Harvey Wilgus in front of students during a school lunch break in Sheffield last February. He's currently being sentenced. The rate at which prices are rising stayed at 3.8% in September. Easing food costs has meant inflation remained unchanged for the third month in a row. A man who was deported to France as part of the one-in, one-out deal has returned to the UK on a small boat. The migrant's been detained by the Home Office and will be sent back to France. And Storm Benjamin's expected to bring heavy rain and winds of up to 70 miles an hour to the UK later. The Met Office has issued yellow weather warnings across England and Wales. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
This is Times Radio.
Direct Line's flexible business cover means I only pay for the cover I need. That's how it's done.
Imagine if that's how everything got done.
Like dominating the pub quiz.
Final question. What is the population of Mongolia?
3,537,947.
It's absolutely correct. This week's winner is none of your quizness.
Direct Line. That's how it's done.
Underwritten by UK Insurance Limited.
Looking to grow your investments and generate a long-term income? The Scottish American Investment Company, also known as Saints, could help. Saints has been investing for over 150 years and focuses on growing capital as well as income by investing in a diverse range of companies from around the world. Saints is managed by Bailey Gifford, manager for some of the UK's best-known investment trusts. Find out key information and more at baileygifford.com. As with any investment, capital is at risk and income is not guaranteed.
Here's the truth about AI. AI is only as powerful as the platform it's built into. ServiceNow puts AI to work for people across your business, removing friction and frustration for your employees, supercharging productivity for your developers, providing intelligent tools for your service agents to make customers happier. All built into a single platform you can use right now. That's why the world works with ServiceNow. Visit servicenow.com/UK/AI for people.
Daryl Morris wraps up the weekend's news and takes a look at the week ahead, Saturday and Sunday from 10 p.m.
Weekday afternoons on Times Radio with Wix. Ready to start planning your new kitchen or bathroom? If you'd like a personalised design, the Wix free design service can guide you through the whole process, including a free home measure. Book today at wix.co.uk.
Welcome back. You're listening to me, Dom Jolly. Now, I am awaiting to do my interview with Tony Hale of the new movie Sketch and a Veep, a show I absolutely love. But he's not around, apparently. He's not ready yet. So we shall see what we do. But in between, while we're waiting for Tony Hale, we can deal with one of the stories I think I was most fascinated with this week. The director of the Louvre Museum is set to appear before French senators after priceless crown jewels were stolen from the museum. Lance Descartes, which is a great name, will be asked how a gang of four thieves, who are still yet to be identified, were able to carry out Sunday's heist. And I'm joined now by David Chazan, Times contributor based in Paris. David.
Yeah, hello there. Well, Laurence Descartes, as you say, is about to appear before a Senate committee, and she's expected to get a pretty tough grilling, although there are reports that she has already offered to resign, except that her resignation was refused by President Macron.
Why was that refused? I mean, the whole thing seems quite extraordinary. It is a I often think it's not really anyone's, it's not the government's fault, but it does seem an extraordinary thing that these people break in to the Louvre in the middle of the day and a kind of break, look like a scene from Ocean's 11. So, I mean, how big has this got in France?
Oh, absolutely huge. People are furious. They're humiliated. I mean, imagine if the crown jewels had been stolen from the Tower of London.
Yeah.
It's equivalent to that. And the reason that President Macron refused the Louvre director's resignation is because he sees her as being part of a movement to renovate and modernize the Louvre. And she is on record as having pointed out some of the failings in the security systems, the fact that a third of the Louvre's rooms have got no CCTV, and other problems like that. And so she isn't really seen, at least by the president, as part of the problem. He thinks she's more likely to be part of the solution.
I mean, the first thing is, do we have any idea why normally, I mean, the only thing I know about museum heists is from movies, I'll be honest, like the Italian Job or whatever, but normally they tend to do these things at night. Is there any particular reason people can think of that they do it right in the middle of the day?
Well, they did it during the day. It was exceptionally brazen. It took place in broad daylight, about 9:30 in the morning local time. Visitors were already inside the Louvre. And I think what the thieves were banking on was they showed up with an extendable ladder with a cherry picker.
It wasn't subtle.
To access a first floor room, and they were wearing high-vis vests. And I think what they thought is that everybody was going to mistake them for workmen, which they did. Passers-by didn't really give them a second glance. It's very common for work to be carried out at the Louvre. It's a centuries-old building, often needs repairs and so on. So people thought that's what was probably happening, but it was much more nefarious.
There is this theory, actually, that I've nearly tested, that you can get into almost any event if you wear a high-vis jacket and carry a ladder. No one ever challenges you. But this thing was like a massive fire engine ladder, but I suppose it was the sheer size of it and the fact that you just think, well, no one would do this in the middle of the day. But again, I only know this from, I'm not a policeman, I only know this from films, but was it an inside job? Because they seemed to go up this ladder to a first floor, and they must have hoped that that window was open. How would they know it was open?
Well, the window wasn't open. They used angle grinders, sort of disc handheld power tools with rotating cutter discs on them, to remove the glass from a window, get into the Louvre, and they used the same disc cutters to cut into the display cases where the jewels were held. But I think the investigators are presuming that they did have some inside knowledge of some kind, because they seem to have planned this thing meticulously. They knew exactly where to get into the museum, and they were right beside the display cases with the jewels they were after. So, and the whole robbery took just 7 minutes. They were only inside the museum for 4 minutes. So clearly everything was planned, and one assumes that they'd reconnoitred the room where the jewels were displayed, but possibly also had some inside knowledge of some kind.
Now, you described it sort of as like the French crown jewels. What actually were the jewels that were taken?
Well, they included various pieces that had been worn by the Empress Eugénie, who was the wife of Napoleon III. He was a nephew of Napoleon Bonaparte. There were necklaces, bracelets, brooches, huge ornamental things encrusted with emeralds and diamonds. Other pieces that had been worn by two French queens. So clearly the crown jewels in France, which following the revolution, France has been a republic for a long time. They may not be as important to the French as the crown jewels are to us in the UK, but nevertheless, they're seen as a key part of the national heritage. And I think the whole nation is shocked and angered by this theft and the fact that it was carried out with such apparent ease.
It's all happening in France at the moment, isn't it? I mean, so obviously the raiders themselves not seeming likely to be caught, be put in prison, but a former president is. Sarkozy goes off to prison. How's that gone down in France?
Well, people on the left tend to think he was corrupt, he deserves it. People on the right, many of them are outraged because they think it's an excessive punishment inflicted by left-wing judges. The judiciary in France, certainly judges, tend to be fairly left-wing, and it's very unusual for a prison sentence like this to be enforced before giving the person convicted time to appeal. So normally, Sarkozy would have been able to remain at liberty until his appeal against his conviction for criminal conspiracy. He's accused of having conspired to solicit funding from Libya's former dictator, the late Colonel Gaddafi, to use for his election campaign, although no proof was found that any money was actually transferred to him. So opinions are divided. It's really polarized the nation. The right feel a lot of sympathy for Mr. Sarkozy, and they hope that he will be released soon. The left wing tend to think that he should stay in jail for a long time.
And, you know, obviously, I don't think, I mean, there certainly hasn't been a French president since the war put in prison or jailed. Is there a special prison for him? Is he in some sort of special high security prison, or is he just chucked in with the normal inmates?
Well, he's chucked into a normal prison, La Santé, which is the largest prison within Paris. But he's got a cell to himself. He will be kept separate from all the other inmates because obviously there are fears for his safety. Other convicts might harm him. So even when he goes out to exercise in the prison yard, which he'll be allowed to do for 2 hours a day in two separate sessions, he'll be kept on his own. He's going to be guarded round the clock by two police officers who will sleep in the cell next to his. So a lot of care is being taken to keep him safe, but he is in the same prison as other inmates. He is in the VIP wing, but the single cells in there, which are only occupied by one prisoner, are all pretty much the same. So he's in a 9-square-meter cell like the others. He does have a telephone, a landline on the wall. He has cooking facilities. And he's allowed to take, I think it's 3 books a week from the prison library.
God, it's all very French, that, as a prison sentence. The perfect synergy, of course, would be the people that robbed the Louvre would now break Sarkozy out of prison, and then we really would have a story. Listen, David Chazan, Times contributor based in Paris, thank you very much for joining us there. We are still waiting for my big interview, which is rapidly turning into a small interview and then a non-existent interview with Tony Hale, an actor who I loved from Veep. But now I'm thinking, really, did I like Veep? No, I did like Veep very much, and I'm sure something's just happened to keep him up, and it's not too bad a thing. I'm still getting stuff about marathons. You've really got into this marathon stuff. This is from Dan in Cheltenham. Marathon addiction is very real. You have to be careful. It starts with parkrun, and then it explodes and takes over your life. Before long, you're suggesting to your reluctant wife, why don't we do the Genoa Marathon? Blah, blah. It's a very real problem. I have a feeling that's my neighbour, Dan. I don't know. I can't check that or not. Brian here. Hi, Dom. Just got in from the gym and switched on Times Radio.
I heard the bit about Shackleton the cat. That was a very brief bit, Brian, but okay. No idea why you're talking about Shackleton. We weren't. I just mentioned someone whose cat was called Shackleton after I mentioned a dog called Traitor. You've missed an exciting afternoon. But any excuse to tell you about the best wine bar in the UK. Okay, we're going to go with this, or at least in Bear, Shackleton's of Bear. Give them a shout. Jill and Steve might give me a free large Malbec when I'm next in. Many thanks. Brian Mayer from Bear, Lancashire. P.S. They're distant relatives of Ernest Shackleton, by the way. I think the moment I started reading that, I regretted it. I have not been paid to promote that particular wine bar. This was just all gone very strange. And I'm blaming no one but Tony Hale, who's just left me here drifting and waffling for about half an hour. I think this is a test. I'm going to pass it. It's absolutely fine. So what do I want to know? We're going to go to the ads, I'm being told. But no, first I want to find out, what are the stupidest dog names that you've come across? I'm going to start with Traitor, which is what was used to be hurled across squares in Cheltenham every morning. Traitor, sadly, no longer with us. Died this summer in Spain. I think that's why he was called Traitor, actually, because he was a Spanish dog who'd come over to England. But that's kind of complicated. But send me in your strange cat and dog names. Tell me who you think should be the next guest editor of Country Life. Donald Trump apparently is a no, but maybe we can get J.D. Vance. I'm now being told Tony Hale's still not here, and we're going to go to the ads.
Times Radio Breakfast with Nationwide. Start your day with Times Radio's essential morning briefing. With intelligent conversation and incisive analysis from some of the most respected names in politics, culture and entertainment. Hear well-informed opinion and quality journalism on all the big stories making the headlines. Times Radio Breakfast, tomorrow morning from 6, with Nationwide, a good way to bank.
Download the free Times Radio app from the App Store or Google Play today.
Growing a business takes a powerful team. People who think big, raise the bar and smash expectations. People who are feeling at their best, not worried and waiting for healthcare. If you're ready to take your business to the next level, you need a team that's ready to deliver. Bupa helps your people to get health worries seen and sorted with fast access to expert advice, including GPs and physios. Your team will have fast help for muscle, bone and joint problems, plus mental health services and cancer cover as standard, so they're ready for whatever life throws at them, at home and at work. Take your business further by building a happier, healthier and more motivated team. And as prevention is better than cure, your team will have access to our digital wellbeing services, including 1,500 gym classes, mindfulness programs and expert content. That's better for your team and better for your business. Get ready to power your growth with small business health insurance that powers your people. Let's get growing. Search Bupa Small Business.
Amazon has increased funding for employees to £3,000 a year every year for career development. Like Juliet, she's now a trained technician. And to her, the sound of machinery in need of repair reminds her of how far she's come. In 2 years, she's landed her dream job, providing her with valuable skills. That's up to £3,000 every year for career development at Amazon. Eligibility conditions apply.
Off Air, the podcast with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
As you know, I'm more of an expert on rap than I am on the markets.
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee delve a bit further into the day's news and give their views on all the hot topics of the day.
Let's not accuse anybody at this stage in the game. Or should we? No, let's not.
Unencumbered and off air.
I don't think that we should spend too long
talking about that night when I wasn't there. Oh no, I'm going to bring it up.
Off Air, the podcast, now available on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Welcome back. You're still listening to me, Dom Jolly, sitting in for Jane and Fee, and you're supposed to be in the middle of my incredible interview with Tony Hale, ex of Veep, but he's still not here. Bad news for me, but good news for Brian, if you remember Brian, because he said, thanks, Dom, and Tony Hale Cheers, Large Malbec it is. So we're here to help, we really are. Now, the incursion of around 20 Russian drones into Polish airspace at the beginning of September was a wake-up call for Europe. NATO aircraft were scrambled to shoot them down as sirens wailed into the early hours of the morning. And nearly every day since then, drones have been reported above airports, military facilities and critical infrastructure across Europe and even the US. Defence Secretary John Healey announced a plan this week to allow British troops to shoot down drones over military bases, and the UK is not alone in taking the growing threat more seriously. So what's Europe's plan to fight Putin's drones? Today's The Story podcast looks at that in depth. Manveen Rana has been speaking to The Times and Sunday Times Berlin correspondent Oliver Moody.
Taking down a drone over a remote forested stretch of the Polish-Belarusian border, where the only casualties are likely to be some bison, is a very different proposition to knocking a drone out of the sky over Heathrow. In the most permissive context, on the front line, there's actually an unbelievably ingenious range of technologies, ranging from kind of jamming and spoofing devices through to very sophisticated armoured vehicle-mounted Gatling guns, through to high-energy lasers like those that the Brits and the Israelis have developed, through to fairly cheap drones.
Lasers to take down the drones before they, as they come over.
Yeah, which is tricky because the drones are often moving very quickly and you need to really focus this highly intense beam of light. But it does sound as though the technology in Europe is pretty advanced and the Israelis have already demonstrated it in defending their country. You can also deploy drones that hunt other drones. There's all kinds of stuff that you can do in a domestic setting over a sort of hub airport near a city, for example. The options are much more limited. You want to be extremely careful before you shoot something down, try and work out where it would land and make sure it doesn't cause even more damage. And here it turns out that if you are talking about a kind of standard hobby drone that is tied to its user by a radio connection, jamming is actually pretty safe. What the drone tends to do is just hover paralyzed in midair for a bit, and then typically they will often try and make their way back to their users, which is great because not only is it safe, but it's also leading you right the way back to the operator so that law enforcement can then go and arrest them.
Some of those bits of technology sound fascinating and incredibly useful, but I suspect also expensive. And these are bits of kit that we haven't necessarily had to think about before. You know, in our past attempts to invest in defence, we've been looking at tanks and fighter planes. Drones are sort of the new frontier. How long is it going to take Europe and NATO to get to a point where they feel like they have this drone wall, that they have invested enough to be able to create a proper defence against Russian drones?
This is the really interesting thing, that these systems are not individually usually that expensive. And it's quite baffling to me that the authorities have not bought more of them already and kind of taken this threat seriously, that it has taken a crisis like we saw in Poland to galvanize them into action more than 3 years into the full-scale Russian invasion of Ukraine.
That was the Times and Sunday Times Berlin correspondent Oliver Moody speaking to Manveen Rana. You can hear more on The Story podcast, one story told in depth each day, and it's available for free wherever you listen to podcasts. You'll feel a little bit that I'm slowing down my delivery, because guess what? Still no Tony Hale. Shall I tell you a little bit about Tony Hale, since he hasn't turned up to tell us about himself? He was on Veep, which genuinely he was fantastic in. If you haven't seen Veep, it's about a vice president, fictional vice president with Julia Louis-Dreyfus, and he was the kind of bag carrier, and he was sort of, he'd sit behind her and whisper into her ear, telling her all the people that she was about to meet. He was fantastic. And he's in this great new film, which I watched this morning in preparation for my big interview, called Sketch. And now I'm minded to slag it off, but I'm not going to, because it really is a great, great film, actually. Reminded me a bit of The Goonies. It sort of went back to the 80s, one of those great family movies that you can all watch, an intelligent kids film. It was really, really good, and thankfully something that isn't some sort of superhero franchise. I absolutely loved it. So despite him not being here, I will very much recommend that you watch Sketch. And Tony Hale, you can send me a bottle of Malbec later to thank me for that. I did actually once come across a Gary type. He plays Gary in Veep. I was on a train and I stopped in Kemble Station, and I was unceremoniously moved out of a four-seat area because Princess Anne was getting on the train. And so she sat down with two of her people. So obviously I peered nosily through the back of the seats and watched as she was taken through her day. She had a book that she was being taken through, and it literally was someone doing Gary-like stuff. You will arrive at 9:14, you will meet a man called Steve, who you've met once before. Steve loves Lego and has two dogs. It was that kind of stuff. So those people do exist, but we could neither get Princess Anne nor Tony Hale this afternoon. But I'm not sure that's a bad thing. John has written in, got a cat called August, a stray we found strangely in August. And Dom, not me, says, I know someone on the estate has a dog called AU because it's a golden retriever. Very good. We enjoy that very much. Right, let's do something else. Let's go to the state pension being set to rise by 4.8% next year, in line with wage growth, putting the Chancellor under pressure to scrap the controversial triple lock. I'm joined now by Holly Mead, the Times money editor, to discuss what today's money stories mean for your personal finance. Holly, what does it mean?
Good afternoon. I must say, though, you've given me a massive job promotion there that might upset the actual money editor. So
just consider it done. I had a word with them, and apparently it's just been pushed through straight away, so it's fine.
Congratulations. A 4.8% pay rise, like all the pensioners, that I've just got the job promotion instead.
Okay. Well, I'm sorry, Holly, but listen, you know, I'm just waffling here for this half hour, so I'm just pleased that you're here to help. So what does it all mean, Holly?
What it means is more sums for Rachel Reeves, I should imagine, ahead of next month's budget. So for anyone who doesn't know, the state pension goes up each year by what's called the triple lock. And this was introduced under the coalition government. And the idea was to make sure that pension incomes kept pace with the cost of living. So it goes up each year by the highest out of inflation, average wage growth, or 2.5%. And the trouble is, we've had some really crazy figures over the last few years. I don't need to remind you about the 11% inflation we had a couple of years ago, that mean that pensioners are getting these quite sizable income rises each year, and it is putting a strain on the public purse. So the highest out of those this year was average wage growth. It's 4.8%. So the state pension for those who get the full new state pension from April will go up to about £241 a week. And it already costs the government £125 billion a year to provide state pension. It's about 11% of public spending. So I think this is a bit of a head scratcher.
What does this all mean for public finances in general?
We talk about this every budget. Should we get rid of the triple lock?
Yeah.
The answer is probably yes, because that was only ever designed to protect on the downside. And you could probably get the wage growth out of there or put a cap in so we weren't suddenly funding 11% increases in it. It's about fairness, though, isn't it? Because equally, people pay in good faith into a system on the understanding that they will be looked after in their dotage. But I think another worry is that income tax thresholds have obviously been frozen for the last few years. We know they're going to remain frozen for the next few years. And actually, we're now getting to the point that the full state pension, if you get that, if you even get an extra £100 a year more out of private pension income, you're going to be starting to pay tax. So you're actually bringing millions more pensioners into the self-assessment tax system by doing this as well. And that is probably a headache for HMRC and more admin for them that they don't need as well.
Is it good news or bad news, very briefly, all this? It sounds, I don't know, it just all sounds, it sounds like my last half hour, actually, to be honest with you, Holly. It just sounds confused. And I don't know, could be good, could be bad. That was Holly Mead, definitely not the Times money editor. This much we know. I'm sorry I couldn't bring you Tony Hale. Tony Hale, I think, is somewhere weeping that he didn't have the chance to talk for me. That is all from me today. Jane and Fee will be back tomorrow from 2. Don't forget, you can get even more of them on their daily podcast, Off Air with Jane and Fee, available wherever you get your podcasts from.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you, Dom. At 4 o'clock, I'm John Pienaar and this is Times Radio Drive. And here are the headlines. The last remaining candidate to be named chair of the grooming gang's inquiry has withdrawn. The government says it's disappointed after former police officer Jim Gamble stepped back, and it's understood the number of people who've come to the UK on small boats so far this year has surpassed the total who arrived in 2024. And coming up, just over a month until Rachel Reeves' autumn budget, what do the political and economic environments allow her to do? Will anything satisfy the voters' need to start feeling better off? Well, the government's grooming gangs inquiry loses both of its possible shortlisted chairs. We'll be talking about what comes next. And with the NATO Secretary General in Washington, D.C., what is the latest White House thinking on Ukraine?
This is Times Radio.
And now the news with James Kitchen.
Thank you, John. Good afternoon. The government says it's disappointed after the last remaining candidate to be named chair of the grooming gangs inquiry pulled out. The former police officer Jim Gamble says it's clear that a lack of confidence due to my previous occupation exists among some. Four survivors withdrew from the panel helping to establish the investigation over concerns about its focus, scope and trust in those leading it. Richard Scorer is head of abuse law and public inquiries at Slater & Gordon, who's represented victims of the grooming gangs. Speaking to Times Radio, he described his frustration at the government's approach.
It's a kind of British disease, really, that we have these hugely expensive inquiries and yet recommendations simply sit on the shelf. And I will always defend the value of public inquiries, but that value is only going to be there if the recommendations are actually implemented. And ultimately, that's actually a matter for politicians who have to do the implementation.
The Prime Minister's repeated that the investigation won't be watered down. A 15-year-old boy has been given a life sentence with a minimum of 16 years for the murder of the Sheffield teenager Harvey Wilgoose. The killer was earlier named for the first time as Mohammed Umar Khan. Khan stabbed Harvey in the chest at All Saints Catholic High School in Sheffield during a lunch break in February. The court heard Khan had a history of carrying knives to school. Angela Rayner has said there is no excuse not to pay taxes owed after resigning as Deputy Prime Minister last month. The former Housing Secretary was speaking for the first time since stepping down amid a row over stamp duty. Addressing the Commons, she insisted it was an honestly made mistake, adding, "When you make a mistake, you take responsibility."
The last few weeks have been incredibly tough on my family, with my personal life so much in the public eye. All of us in public life know all too well the toll of the intense scrutiny we face places on our loved ones. But I've always believed in the highest standards of transparency and accountability. And it is what the public expects, and it is the price we pay for the privilege of service.
It's understood the number of people who have come to the UK on small boats so far this year has surpassed the total who arrived in 2024. Following a number of crossings this morning, it's thought the figure's now higher than the 36,816 who made the journey last year. The government's vowed to take action to bring illegal migration down. And the US Vice President J.D. Vance has expressed optimism about Gaza's fragile ceasefire as he holds talks with Israel's Prime Minister. The peace plan had appeared in doubt over the weekend after a burst of violence, but is holding up for now. Mr. Vance, who's been welcomed to Jerusalem by Benjamin Netanyahu, says it's actually going better than expected.
Nothing existed even a week and a day ago. That's going to require a lot of work. It requires a lot of ingenuity. But again, having seen what's already been built in just the past 7 days, I think that we're on an incredible pathway here to do something that has never been done.
And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on the Times radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. John Pienaar at Drive on Times Radio.
Hello, I'm John Pienaar with Drive on Times Radio. Thanks for joining me. You know, things are bad, really bad, when the Chancellor starts blaming Brexit for the state of the economy and says it's a reason she'll have to put up taxes in her coming budget. Not that the government is about to denounce Brexit as a mistake, though many, maybe most of the country, think that now, according to the polls, and maybe even more Labour MPs wish that she would. Keir Starmer, his top team, will not rip the scab off that wound. But Rachel Reeves is in a very tight fiscal corner, and she's not about to take all the blame for it, is she? Or even a share of the blame, much as her critics and opponents try to heap it onto her shoulders. As it is, the Chancellor's casting around for ways to put up taxes without too obviously breaking her election pledge not to hit working people. If doctors and lawyers in partnerships imagined they were working people too, turns out they were wrong, according to the Times. So let's look at the can of worms, the cans of worms that Rachel Reeves is opening up as her moment of reckoning on Budget Day, November the 26th, draws closer. What are you thinking? Send me a text, 87222. Start with the word Times, or a tweet to @TimesRadio. And a bit later, British troops are heading to Gaza to help work towards a lasting peace, a peace which still seems pretty distant today. The Vice President of America, J.D. Vance, and Donald Trump's senior advisors are there in the region now. Talking optimistically, as we heard in the news, is that optimism justified? We'll talk about that too. First, though, in a Times exclusive today, the Chancellor is set to launch a £2 billion tax raid targeting many lawyers, family doctors and accountants. Steve Swinford, the political editor of the Times, uncovered the story for the paper's new politics podcast, The State of It.
There are things called limited liability partnerships, which are used by lawyers, particularly in magic circle firms, these are your megabucks ones, and by some weird anachronism of the tax system, they're not subject to employers' national insurance. So our companies are, our businesses are, but they're not, and they're also treated as self-employed people. And Rachel Reeves is looking at that, and I'm told her view is that is fundamentally unfair. You have some of the richest people in the country that are paying less tax as a proportion of their income than other people, and she wants to redress that with a kind of national insurance tax rate on those very wealthy people.
Stephen Swinford of The Times. So Rachel Reeves saying the economic damage caused by Brexit is forcing her to take action in the budget. The Liberal Democrat leader, Ed Davey, hit back and had this to say at Prime Minister's questions.
I know members opposite are relieved. They are finally allowed to say the Conservatives' Brexit deal is a disaster. Yeah. But, Mr Speaker, that can't just be a political ruse to attack the Honourable Member for Clacton, however much he deserves it. Or even worse, Mr Speaker, given we still have the highest inflation in the G7, it mustn't be a smokescreen to raise taxes on ordinary people.
And the member for Clacton is, of course, Nigel Farage. And that was Ed Davey. Let's welcome now to the programme, live on the line, Oliver Wright, the policy editor at The Times. Hi to you, Oliver.
Hello.
So this is a great Times exclusive, isn't it, on the Chancellor's plan to hit professional partners, doctors, lawyers, accountants and so on, with national insurance worth £2 billion to the Treasury. Now, look, you could try to argue that they're not working people, and that will be the argument, I guess, but you can also expect, and the Chancellor can certainly expect, some pretty well-organised blowback.
Yes, I think that's absolutely true. These are not groups of people known to be shy about coming forward. She will say, look, this isn't a raise in one of the three main taxes, i.e. national insurance, VAT or income tax for everyone. This is a very targeted tax raid at those people who are arguably have the, as Reeves would say, the broadest shoulders are able to pay. And it would help fill her black hole.
Yeah, I mean, there is this speculation still bubbling, isn't there, Ollie, on whether the